Please be seated. The second case for oral argument this morning is Braden McCarron, appellant versus State of South Dakota Appellee. For the appellant, Mr. McCarron, we have Mr. Michael Butler, Mr. Clint Sargent, and Ms. Raleigh Hansman, all attorneys from Sioux Falls. Mr. Butler, I understand you'll be presenting this morning?
Yes, sir.
Very well. And for the State of South Dakota, we have Ms. Patricia Archer, an Assistant Attorney General from Pierre. As you notice, this is not our normal lineup. We had Justice Zinner, Justice Wilbur, and Justice Kern disqualify themselves, and the court has appointed the Honorable Robin Hellman, a judge from the Second Judicial Circuit, the Honorable Scott Myron, the presiding judge of the Fifth Judicial Circuit, and the Honorable Susan Sabers, circuit judge from the Second Judicial Circuit, to sit in their places. With that, Mr. Butler, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice. In December of 2012, here in Pierre, South Dakota, three young men who were friends were at the home of Braden McCarron. While at the home, a gun discharged, killing Dalton Williams. He was also 16 years old at the time, as was my client, and a third party who was present, Tyus Youngberg. 911 was called by Tyus. The 911 call indicated that there had been messing around in the home when the gun went off. It shot. On that 911 call, Braden McCarron can be heard in the background. Also, Tyus Youngberg can be heard instructing Braden to sit down on the curb, wait for law enforcement to get there. It is obvious from listening to Braden McCarron's voice, he is rattled, shook up, upset. When law enforcement arrived, Tyus Youngberg was asked, had there been a fight, had there been an argument? He said, no. We were messing around when the gun went off. Later, Mr. Youngberg is taken down to law enforcement, as is Mr. McCarron, again, multiple times. Was there an argument? No, we were messing around. We were just messing around. I begin my argument by making that point for a specific reason. In the state's brief, and as they argued at trial, and as they continue to assert, the motive for the shooting was an argument. Their star witness, their lone eyewitness, denied it repeatedly. And those are the undisputed facts. It's not disputed. They simply assert it in order to provide motive, in this case, for the shooting. There was an arraignment in January of 2013, a transfer hearing. It was denied. The case had a motion hearing in August. It ultimately went to trial in 2014 in Winter, South Dakota. The charges were first-degree murder as to Dalton, first-degree attempted murder as to Tyus, aggravated assault as to Tyus, all involving the weapon. At no time throughout the duration of the pretrial proceedings did the state ever assert or claim that it was anything other than an intentional murder. Mr. McCarron was only arraigned on intentional first-degree murder and intentional attempted first-degree murder. The case proceeded to trial. Prosecution informed the jury they intended to prove the gun was intentionally loaded, intentionally pointed, and intentionally fired. The case went to trial. The state put on its case. The defense put on its case. The evidence closed. The parties went home. The next day would be final argument. We arrived at the courthouse. We all met with Judge Brown, at which point, 90 minutes prior to argument, the state said it wanted the jury to be instructed that it could find Braden guilty of second-degree murder. Second-degree murder requires finding a separate, additional state-of-mind intent element, that being depravity of mind, that his actions were imminently dangerous, and that they evinced a depraved mind regardless of human life. Evincing a depraved mind regardless of human life would require a showing that his conduct demonstrated an indifference to the life of others, that not only showed a disregard for the safety of another, but the lack of regard for the life of another. Now, Mr. McCarron didn't testify in the first-degree murder case on the advice of counsel, because counsel discerned that the state had not proven first-degree murder. The jury verdict vindicated that belief. but they did convict on second-degree murder over objection to the instruction. We come now before this court with a very simple argument, really. Braden McCarron had a right to defend himself on the second-degree murder charge. It is a principle embedded in case law and the Constitution. It has been repeated time and again by this court. Decisions such as Huber, you have the right to defend yourself. The concomitant right is to be notified of what you are defending against. At no time did Braden McCarron know that he would be defending against a second-degree murder charge. What would his defense be involving a different state of mind element? Would he have testified? He was not informed that he had a right to testify as to second-degree murder charge. It's a state of mind offense. While it involves an objective assessment of conduct, state of mind is relevant. He was never informed he could put on a defense. In this case, at a pretrial proceeding to transfer, two psychologists testified, one a neuropsychologist, one a psychologist. Braden McCarron functioned at the equivalent level psychologically and mentally as an 11 or 12-year-old. That was put on at the transfer hearing. It was testified to that Braden McCarron had a very severe case of hyperattention deficit disorder, one of the most serious seen, the consequences of which that young man didn't anticipate the consequences of his action, didn't think through, and would act impulsively, very impulsively. Would that evidence be relevant to a second-degree murder charge in assessing not only the conduct but the circumstances of the conduct? In State v. Lively, the court held when a challenge to the second-degree murder statute was raised as to its constitutionality and its notice, the court said what you assess is not only the conduct but the circumstances of the conduct. This court has held, and it is embedded in our law as well, when someone engages in reckless conduct, the question becomes, did they knowingly and consciously disregard a substantial risk of harm and proceed forward anyway? Now, that's to convict of second-degree manslaughter. So to convict of second-degree murder with a penalty on par of first-degree murder, life without parole, you could set aside that he's a juvenile in case. That's what the legislature said. It is conduct on par, nearly equivalent to, if not equivalent to, except with extreme circumstances, to first-degree murder warranting life without parole. So it is far beyond the consequences of mere reckless conduct. Reckless conduct requires knowledge of what you're doing. Therefore, evidence of his mental development, his mental acuity, evidence that he had the executive functioning capacity of an 11 or 12-year-old would obviously be highly relevant to a jury assessing not only his actions, but the circumstances of his actions. In this case, Tyus Youngberg repeatedly and at trial stated he thought it was an accident. We were messing around. No one was mad. We were not fighting. The circumstances of the conduct. We have cases decided by this court involving second-degree murder, State versus Jenner, depravity of mind, 70 stab wounds to a child. We have cases Benny Lively beat his mother over a period of time, eventually shot her in the face. That was second-degree murder. State v. Miller, shooting somebody through a car driving down the interstate. We have child abuse, death, second-degree murder, barbaric actions showing an extreme indifference to life. Here, we look at the circumstances of what occurred when the sole and lone eyewitness says it was an accident. We were messing around. Does it rise to that level? Was it reckless conduct? That would be second-degree manslaughter if, in fact, it was reckless. At trial, it was a decision was made not to have Braden testify. The evidence on a recording was Braden saying he thought the gun was unloaded. But again, it was the belief of the defense. Specific intent was not shown nor proven. Therefore, he didn't testify. And in that regard, we were correct. State versus Lawrence decided in 1982... involved a case nearly factually identical. A 16-year-old was charged with first-degree murder. He went to trial. The prosecution requested a second-degree murder lesser offense instruction. The court gave it over objection. The Supreme Court reversed. They pointed out in that case The defendant was defending against a crime with separate and distinct elements. The state's brief in this case focuses on somewhat of the history of lesser offense instructions involving homicide cases. And it is, in fact, an interesting history. I'll agree with that.
It's pretty confusing at times, actually.
And when we reached the Waelke decision, and that court then points out that we are now addressing homicide differently, and of course in 2005 the legislature 2216.20.1 and 20.2 codified this lesser offense approach on homicides.
Does that affect the Lonas decision?
I don't believe it does in this case, and here's the reason, because again, Lonas was a notice case, an objection case. It wasn't a case of the defense arguing for it. But here's what happened, Justice, I think this is very important, what Judge Tucker said in his law review article. Because he said the elements test, which was discussed in Hoadley a few years prior to Waelke, in and of itself was difficult to apply. Because a true elements test is fewer elements of which you must commit the lesser to commit the greater. It's a subset thereof. Well, in fact, with second-degree murder, it's not a pure lesser offense in that regard. You can commit first without committing second. There's no question. So it's not a pure subset. But what Judge Tucker proposed and what was adopted was, he said, when you have a different intent element, we can treat that as a lesser offense. That'll uncomplicate it, and therefore, even though they're different, we'll treat them as lesser, and we only have to look to the facts. But what's important about what Judge Tucker said, and when we look at that, Judge Tucker said different intent, different state of mind. Okay, they're different. You're defending against something different. Braden didn't get to defend against something different. The state argues, by virtue of a statutory codification of the homicide lesser offenses, Braden McCarron, as with anybody currently charged with first-degree murder, you're on notice. The state might, and I repeat, may, at the conclusion of all the evidence, ask the judge to instruct the jury they can find you guilty of a charge you were never arraigned of, never advised you had a chance to defend against, but you were supposed to assume it by virtue of statutory enactment. Now, in any case, with someone charged with a felony, they must appear in court to be arraigned. They must appear in court to be advised. They must inform the court they understand the charges and their rights. That didn't happen here with second-degree murder. Instead, the state said, you're effectively on notice because the legislature said so. The legislature didn't say anything about notice, but they did talk about codification. We all know, those of you who have been circuit court judges, it's a rare case when the prosecution does ask for a lesser included defense instruction. Defense asks for it, it certainly waives any notice requirement. This case is, does he have a right, prior to putting on his defense, to be notified he's defending against a different charge than what he has been charged with? They had 2 years to amend their indictment. They had 2 years to supersede the indictment. When the prosecution argued to the jury in its rebuttal regarding the lesser offense instruction, which was the only time they addressed it, they said, it is my responsibility to give you jurors the option of convicting on more than one charge. Translated, I failed to prove my case, and I'd like you to consider second-degree murder. Had the state believed it was its duty to give the jury an option, as we know, they could have indicted on first, on second, the manslaughter charges. That's not unusual to be done. The sole power to charge rests exclusively with the state, not the defendant.
All right. Just on procedure, I mean, if you have to notify of all lesser included offenses in the indictment, that's really an alternative charge, is it not? I'm just looking to what the state's attorneys and the trial courts need to deal with. How do we deal with lesser included offenses? When do you have, in your case, you had 60 minutes, 90 minutes to prepare a defense. At what point are you saying you should have had notice that there were going to be lesser included offenses?
All we had is a chance to prepare an argument, not a defense.
All right, granted.
That was done. The evidence was closed. when it was the prosecution, and we're not on equal footing in the case, I, as the defense attorney, cannot make a demand to have a charge brought. It's not my right to go to the grand jury and insist on certain lesser charges being set out in the indictment. That power rests with the state exclusively, and I accept that. So I have no say in the matter until the close of the evidence. Now, we have true lesser offense instructions, first-degree manslaughter. The difference between that, first-degree murder, the absence of intent, that's a pure lesser. It's one less. You have to commit the first degree to commit first-degree murder. So you're not defending against something in addition to. In State versus Primo, 1982, the court said the element of depraved mind murder is a separate and distinct element. Every defendant has the right to defend against the elements. Braden McCarron never defended against the element of depraved mind murder. I'm sorry, Judge.
Well, so are you saying that, and I can't remember exactly in, like, Woloki, if we said that second and first, are you saying that our jurisprudence, or at least the way we've been looking at the elements test with first and second degree murder, is wrong and that really isn't capable of an element analysis?
No. And I think that's where Justice Severson, a little bit where the argument gets sidetracked. I'm not here to say second-degree murder cannot be instructed on as a lesser offense in a homicide trial. I'm not. Defense may very well request it. They frequently do it in first-degree murder cases where the death penalty is on the table. They want the jury to consider second-degree murder. The state may ask for it, and the defense may not object to it. They can be instructed on it. I am not here to argue, based on the jurisprudence, what the legislature enacted, it cannot be instructed on. This is a notice case. This is a notice and an actual showing of prejudice case. Therein is the difference.
I guess I'm not sure your answer to Justice Severson. When should you have gotten that notice?
I believe at least by the close of the state's case. If we had been notified by the time we put on a defense, now logistical problems that would have raised might have been some. We might have said to the court, we need a week continuance because Dr. Swenson's from North Dakota, Dr. Price is from Sioux Falls, but they've notified us now. We need to consult with the client about whether he should or should not testify, but we want to bring our experts in and judge under the circumstances. We appeal to the bench and ask perhaps for 24, 48, 72 hours to get our witnesses present, but let us defend. So ideally, yes, you'd like to know well in advance of trial. But at this point, it can be accomplished when the state rests its case. It becomes a bit of a casino-style approach here. If the state can sit back, tell the jury, I'm going to prove it. Now they've lost confidence. Let's see what the defense does. Now I've decided, okay, I'm going to ask for it. But I'm going to wait until they do everything. Now I'm going to ask for it. We don't get to respond except argue.
How does the fact that you talked about lesser-included offenses at the pretrial hearing?
How does that
affect your notice argument?
Not at all. The state filed a motion to preemptively have the court rule the defense could not request at trial a second-degree manslaughter, at which point I responded that it was premature to be ruling on any defense request for a lesser-included instruction because the trial had not commenced. Because as I knew, and Judge Brown was well aware, that it was a fact-determinative test to get the lesser-included defense. I realize the state from that reasons, therefore we should have anticipated the state would ask for second-degree murder at the close of the defense. I just can't follow that line of reasoning very well. We were simply saying, Judge, you can't prohibit us at this point from asking because you've not heard the first witness, which the court agreed. So the mere fact that I have a knowledge of lesser-included defenses cannot be translated into a conclusion that Braden McCarron and I knew the state would ask for second-degree murder when they closed their case. They were adamant throughout, Judge. Transfer hearing, trial, everything. They never mentioned second-degree murder until all the evidence was in. Again, we would only have asked for notice at the minimum before we put on our defense to defend against two new elements, or an element that was not present in the case which they brought to trial. I see my time is running short, and there are other issues, of course, which we thought in this case were important. I don't intend to waive any of them, one of which dealt with Braden McCarron when the police arrived They said, who was the shooter? Braden was sitting on the curb, and he said, I was. Instructed him to get in the car, got into the car with him, and then asked him what occurred, at which point Braden went through a description of the events more than once. We took the position in this case, and we've argued, and we moved to suppress, that once he was put into that car and questioned by what occurred in this case, there was a parental notification obligation by statute, at the very least a Miranda obligation, which he didn't get. The state has responded by saying, in effect, either one, he's not really in custody. I believe a 16-year-old told to get in a police car would think he was in custody. And two, that this was just on-the-scene investigatory questioning, citing State v. Butnick, I think. But in Butnick, that was a case where the officer arrived at an accident scene and asked who was the driver. That's all he asked. And the person identified himself. That's what happened in this case. Those statements should be suppressed in our view. Finally, in the last 15 seconds, I don't want to waive the right to respond. The prohibition ruled by the court with regard to cross-examination on the witness we identified as TD, who had a mental illness known as conduct disorder, the features of which included dishonesty, deceit, etc. We were not allowed to cross-examine on that evidence, and he, along with Tyus Youngberg, were two critical witnesses in the state's case. We were flatly prohibited, even though his testimony was argued, and I believe the jury could have used his testimony to find second-degree murder, because he alleged so many statements Mr. Demarius made that were so, frankly, far off the wall. But we were prohibited by the court, saying his mental diagnosis was not relevant to our right to cross-examine. My time is up.
I have a question for you, though.
Yes, sir.
If you would prevail in this court, what would you see the proceeding being like back in the circuit court? A full jury trial on the charge that you said you never got to defend on, or it's a little unique argument? Where do we go from here?
The issue of remedy, our position, at least in the brief, although it wasn't extensively briefed at this point, was that the second-degree murder charge would not go forward. There would not be a trial because he was never charged. That was not briefed. And I don't pretend, as I stand here today, to say that my position is unassailable. State's position is it would go back to be tried then on the lesser offense of which he was convicted, on which we did not have the opportunity to defend. That would be second-degree murder. I would not waive any legal argument that we may make against that position at the time. But again, in the remedy portion of our brief at the very end, we took the position that he should not have to stand trial for it since he was never indicted for it. He was never apprised of his rights on it. All we had was a lesser-included offense instruction. It was the state who took its roll of the dice, you might say, in this case, and was wrong in our view.
Okay. With leave of the chief,
sure.
That raises one more question, which is unusual. We're way over time here, but there were convictions on two charges, the second-degree murder and also an aggravated assault. That isn't appealed, and that's not part of this. So if it is remanded, what is your position?
Well, he was convicted of aggravated assault as to Tyus. And placing another one in fear, our position was there may be sufficient. We didn't appeal it. So that conviction, he's been sentenced on, and it stands. We did raise the issue of the sentence that was imposed as to whether it was
granted
extreme, but we did not appeal the underlying conviction in that case, just the uncharged instruction that contained the additional element.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Butler.
Thank you, Justice.
Ms. Archer, you have 20 minutes, unless we get inquisitive at the end.
Thank you. May it please the court. Counsel. In order to address the issues, it's important to understand just what happened in the McCarran kitchen on December 18, 2012. Three young men were there in the kitchen that day, the defendant, Tyus Youngberg, and Dalton Williams. Now, defendant and Tyus were arguing. And at some point, the defendant went to the front door and retrieved a shotgun from a gun rack that was located beside the front door. He comes back to the kitchen area, and he stands about 10 to 12 feet away from Tyus, At that point, the defendant wants to, and this is his words, scare the shit out of Tyus. He shoulders the gun, he points it at Tyus, and he pulls the trigger. It just clicks. At that point, the defendant goes to a kitchen drawer, pulls out a live 20-gauge shotgun shell, and loads that weapon and points it again. Now, Tyus sees this, and he's heading to a sliding glass door at the other end of the kitchen across from defendant, thinking he would try to escape. His back is turned toward the defendant, and he hears another click. He's unable to open the door, so he turns around thinking he'll try to escape out another door, but he has to go towards the defendant to do it. He is located approximately 5 to 10 feet away from the defendant, and Dalton Williams is right in front of him. They're both facing the defendant. He places his hands on Dalton's shoulders as he tries to go past him. At that precise moment, the defendant pulls the trigger again, and this time the gun fires. Defendant shot Dalton Williams through his wrist and into the center of his chest. Now, for his actions, the defendant was convicted by a jury of second-degree depraved mind murder for killing Dalton Williams. He was also convicted of aggravated assault for using a weapon in a menacing manner for his actions against Tyus Youngberg. The state submits that none of the issues raised by the defendant leads to a conclusion that there is any trial error warranting reversal in this case. I'd like to address the first issue, and that is the lesser included offense instruction. It was entirely proper for the trial judge to have given the second degree depraved mind murder instruction because the defendant and his counsel had notice that it could be given. That notice was based on the indictment itself when read in conjunction with the statutes STCL 2216 20.1 and 20.2. That notice was based on the case law of this court, including State v. Hoadley in 2002 and State v. Giroux in 2004. And the notice was based on the actual conversations that happened amongst counsel and the court in this case. Now, the history of the lesser-included offense instruction is important. And briefly, I'd like to talk about that a bit. The starting point is STCL 23A 26-8, otherwise known as Rule 31C. Now, the predecessor to this rule has been in effect before statehood and, frankly, before the United States Constitution. It's derived from common law all the way back to England. And what that statute says in relevant part is that a defendant may be found guilty of an offense necessarily included in the offense charged. Now, since that time, since that was codified in 1865 here, there's been a long evolution of case law by this court discussing the concept of lesser included offenses. This culminated for purposes of today in State v. Hoadley in 2002. Now, in that case, the defendant was charged with first-degree premeditated murder. He requested an instruction, lesser-included instructions, on Murder 2, Man 1, and Man 2, because he claimed he did not intend to kill the victim. Now, Justice Konkamp wrote the majority opinion for this issue, and he went through the various evolution of the case law and the tests and recognized the law review article of Judge Tucker from 1996 that had also discussed this and made a proposal. And what this court held then in Hoadley was that it was going to adopt what's called the elements test. And in doing so, it concluded that the mens rea component could be considered a lesser element. Ultimately, the court held that, yes, second-degree murder and Man 1 and Man 2 are lesser included offenses of first-degree murder. Ultimately, the court held that it was proper that the trial judge had not given those instructions because the facts didn't warrant it, though. Now, again, a couple years later in State v. Giroux, 2004, this court again recognized the Hoadley holding and recognized again that, yes, second-degree murder is a lesser-included offense. And, you know, I'm reading defense counsel's briefs, and especially the reply brief, and the discussion about true lesser-included, and it certainly sounds like they're trying to argue that this shouldn't be a lesser-included. But that issue has been definitively decided, not only by this court, but by the legislature in its enactment in 2005. And those statutes are worth noting. 2216.20.1 states, murder in the second degree is a lesser-included offense of murder in the first degree. The statute then recites the other lesser-included homicide offenses. 20.2 says, a lesser-included offense instruction shall be given in any homicide trial whenever any facts are submitted to the trier of fact which would support an offense. It goes on to state, the state and the defendant each have the separate right to request a lesser-included offense instruction. It is within the legislature's exclusive province to decide not only what crimes exist in South Dakota, but what lesser-included offenses exist.
All right. Granting that, one of my struggles in dealing with the lesser-included offense issue in this case is that we are dealing with a concept of notice, and that's the rationale behind the elements test is that you can't prove the higher offense without also proving the lesser offense with at least one additional proof. That's the rationale and the reason that they don't have to have notice. But Mr. Butler's arguing that you can't really, no matter what the legislature says, if the elements are not such that you can't really prove that first charge without additional evidence, that the rationale doesn't hold, and therefore they should be required to have noticed that you're going to do it, you're going to request that instruction so they can defend against it.
Okay. And, Your Honor, I mean...
And that's difficult.
Well, and with all respect, I mean, if we're going to go down that trail of deciding whether or not this neatly fits, then we're basically rejecting what the legislature has declared. I mean, they've declared that it's secondary.
They can't declare something that's a constitutional right. They can declare all they want, and if the Constitution says otherwise, it doesn't hold.
Absolutely. And the state's position is that the statute and the Constitution coexist. This is not a matter of the statute somehow trumping the Constitution. They can coexist. And what it boils down to, in all honesty, and this came up in the opening argument, is the statute, when read in conjunction with the indictment, the moment that indictment comes out and is provided to the defendant, that combination is the notice that's required by the United States Constitution for due process. And if that is not the notice, if this court decides that facially, you know, that notice is insufficient, then I'm not sure where that leaves us with the constitutionality of that statute. And the state is certainly not asking the court to declare the statute unconstitutional. And in fact, the defendant is not asking that. The defendant asked below, the trial court specifically said that they were not asking the court to find the statute facially unconstitutional. So then perhaps we're left with an as-applied situation. And if that is the case, the question becomes, and again, this came up earlier, what type of notice is required? What is the state expected to provide, and when? To meet that constitutional threshold.
Is there any problem with the prosecutor's conduct in not dealing with this prior to the time when all of the evidence was closed, and it was 90 minutes before closing argument.
I have two responses, Your Honor. Number one is, I think the state, the prosecutor, and every prosecutor in the state is entitled to rely on the existence of this body of case law and to rely on the statutes as they exist. And so that's simply what was happening. The other point would be, this was brought up. You know, the state filed that pretrial in limine motion to preclude the defendant from being able to get a second-degree man instruction, lesser-included instruction. And 11 days before trial, this was addressed. And defense counsel, Mr. Butler, argued strenuously against it. Said, now is not the time. This is premature.
So when the state files that motion in limine saying, Judge, don't let the defense have a lesser-included offense instruction, isn't implicit in there that the state's saying, we're not going to ask for it either?
I don't think it's implicit at all, because what the state asked was specifically only as to the second-degree man. And I'll grant you, I mean, the discussion specifically about murder two or man one wasn't raised. But as this hearing unfolds, what, you know, counsel for the defendant asserts and what ultimately the trial judge agreed was that we don't need to discuss lesser included until the appropriate time. That appropriate time was at the settling of jury instructions, because it's only then that we know whether or not the facts warrant it.
Well, the state has the burden of putting forth facts to support it. So what they should have known at the end of their case whether or not they've proven it.
Again, Your Honor, it's certainly a state, you know, does everything it can to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. But again, the body of case law, the statutes that are in existence in this state allow a lesser-included offense instruction to be given. And what the statutes say, consistent with the court decisions, is that determination is made once we know whether or not the facts have come in.
If the notice statutes in 20.1 and 20.2 are effectively supposed to put the defense on notice that second-degree murder is in the mix, when they are prepared and begin calling Dr. Price and their witnesses in their case, what is the response then to a relevancy argument from the state when second-degree murder hasn't been charged?
Well, Your Honor, I guess, you know, we don't have that fact in front of us at this point in time, so it's hard to know what a trial judge would do. Obviously, you know, the trial judge assesses the relevancy as the case comes in, and at that moment, I can't, you know, presume what the trial judge would have ruled in that regard. But
what would your office have done, Ms. Archer? Would they have raised a relevance objection? Sure, they would have.
Well, it's certainly possible, but again, then at least, well, we have the issue, and it gets laid out, I'm sure, in chambers about what needs to come in and why. And so then,
does your analysis change in any way based on what the defense does? Let's say the state puts on its case. There's no affirmative notice in mid-trial that depraved mind is in the works. The defense does nothing. They rest. They don't put on a witness. They don't do anything. Does the state just get to stand up and again say, we want depraved mind now? Or does it matter what the defense does? I mean, is it your position that the defense didn't need to? I mean, did your office look at this and say, well, the defense put on a good enough case, so that's okay, so we can raise depraved mind now? Does it matter?
I believe based on, again, on the case law and the evolution of this concept, this rule, is that it doesn't matter. I mean, the notice has technically already been given.
But look at that, though. The defense at the end of the case came to the same conclusion that presumably Attorney Moore did, that first degree wasn't going to happen, that the jury would likely acquit. So if that's the conclusion, does the state get to all of a sudden say, okay, we're going to go for a depraved mind? Defense didn't raise a case. Defense didn't defend against a charge that they weren't facing. They sat down. Hypothetically, they sat down, they didn't put on a case because they thought the first-degree premeditated murder case had failed.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, I'm not certain that it's necessary for the prosecutor to have this. And again, we don't have this in the record. We don't have testimony by the prosecutor or, frankly, by defense counsel about the strategy and thought process that was going on. I don't think it's necessary that the prosecutor affirmatively says, oh, I've totally lost this. I have to do this other. I think the case law in the Beck v. Alabama decision from 1980 tells us that this concept of the lesser included offenses instruction is allowed as a third option to the jury. So it's a matter of giving that jury that option. And so that's first. Second, again, I don't think it matters how the evidence came in and what the defense ultimately chose to do in their case to make this decision. I mean, if the court is going to read the statute as it clearly and unambiguously reads, and that is that the instructions shall be given if the facts warrant it.
So does that mean, under your analysis, that the statute gives notice, the defense in a homicide case where we have this whole litany of lesser includeds that the legislature has passed, that a defendant needs to defend against every conceivable lesser included offense, because, as in this case, the prosecutor may 90 minutes before settling instructions say, oh, by the way, I'm going to ask for who knows what. So they have to defend every potential charge without any notice. Is that your position because of the statute?
The statute, when read in conjunction with the indictment, when it says this is it's charged with first degree premeditated murder, then we know, based on the statute.
All right, hypothetically.
Yes.
What if one of the elements on one of the manslaughters is with a weapon, and it wasn't charged with a weapon? So do they have to assume that in the end they're going to have to deal with a weapons charge? And that's just one of the that came to mind as one of the strange elements in some of them.
Well, obviously, again, because we know that the facts have to meet the ultimate charge that will be instructed on, then obviously the types of mansay that wouldn't fit, we know that those aren't going to be the ones that would be requested. So we know that these are possible lesser included offenses that could be instructed on, and that everybody going into the trial knows that. And it's not just a man, we're acting like the prosecutor was being all devious in waiting until the last moment. But, I mean, given the course of this case and how, especially the pretrial hearing, where that discussion was, no, we are going to deal with lesser-included offense instructions at closing, or at the settling of instructions, I think it was reasonable for the prosecutor to take the court at its word. And so I would like to approach briefly what this notice that Your Honor asked counsel about. Not only when would it be given if the state were to give some type of written or oral notice, but what would it say? Would it say something to the effect of, to the defendant, you are hereby on notice that if this goes to jury trial, and then in that instance, all possible lesser included homicide offenses may be instructed as are listed in 2216.20.1. And if that's the case, then how is that any different than what the statute says? The bottom line is that the question is whether or not the trial judge properly gave this second degree murder instruction based on the facts of the case. And everything before Lonas and since Lonas says that the answer is yes. And again, Lonas doesn't change what the state is saying here today, because, frankly, it's not even clear that Lonas is even being followed anymore.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Butler, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal, sir.
Thank you. A
couple of points. At the outset of her argument, counsel informed the court that what was established at trial is that Braden had the shotgun, pointed the shotgun, it clicked, retrieved a shell, loaded it, it clicked, pointed it at Mr. Youngbird toward Dalton, and then fired and killed Dalton. If the jury had believed that that all was true, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say they might have convicted him of first-degree murder. They didn't. So to stand here and to assert affirmatively that the jury accepted all that as the truth, as shall you, I think exhibits a bit of hubris, frankly. I want to be absolutely clear in what our position is. I'm not here challenging the manner in which the legislature or the court has addressed in its previous decisions when lesser-included offenses, when is something a lesser-included, when can it be given. I'm not here to turn around the body of jurisprudence. I'm talking about this case under these facts when the state charged first-degree murder and waited until all the evidence was in, including the defense, to make an assessment of the strength of its case and then ask for a new charge that required proof of an additional element that we never got to defend against. It's really that simple to say under these facts the state, when counsel stands before the court, says, what were we to do? Well, you could have charged it. That's certainly one option. I don't have, as counsel for Mr. McCarron, any control over that. So you have the charging power. And again, I was in a case with the same prosecutor in Aberdeen, South Dakota, defending a former prosecutor, and I had four superseding indictments. So he knows how to do it. You know how to amend, you know how to change, you know how to put on notice. We had plenty of notice, four superseding indictments. My 16-year-old client is supposed to know that the legislature, at least as to second-degree murder, when the state only charges first-degree murder, he's on notice, whether a judge ever told him or not, that he's got to defend against that, plus decide whether to testify or not. Every other defendant goes to court, sits in front of a judge, and gets arraigned. Now, I looked at the arraignment in this case. If it is so self-evident that second-degree murder could have been sought in this case, though not charged, it was so self-evident, why didn't Judge Brown simply advise Braden of that fact? Seems like it would be a good thing then to start advising people. You should be advised that the state is entitled to ask for a lesser offense of second-degree murder, even though they've not charged first-degree murder. Do you understand that? So you prepare your defense accordingly, and you determine whether you're going to testify accordingly. Perhaps from this point forward, the court should rule prospectively that it should be a part of arraignment. I'm not here to say first-degree manslaughter, second-degree manslaughter. That's a different argument and a different set of circumstances. But first degree clearly is a pure lesser, and whereas clearly second degree murder is not pure. It is, you can commit first without committing second. It is not the subset.
Mr. Butler, what would the notice look like? Ms. Archer says, and accurately so, you told us when you think the bare minimum notice is due to you and your client. What would that notice look like?
Your Honor, I don't think there's any particular importance in its form, but rather its substance, whether the parties go on the record at the close of the state's case and inform the court on the record, Your Honor, we're hereby placing the defense on notice. It is our intention to ask for an instruction on second-degree murder at the close of the defense case. We may say, Judge, that notice is a little untimely, but now we would make application to the court for time if we felt we needed it to get our appropriate witnesses, and when we would deal with it. The court would decide. We might have to make an offer of proof. Those sorts of things could then be hashed out at that moment in time. I think it simply needs to be made a matter of the record in some form or fashion, at a minimum at the close of the state's case. Not for them to make a determination of how they feel about their case, and for the defense to determine, will they ask? I wonder if they will. Should we put Braden on to talk about state of mind, intent? Should we put the doctors on? As two of the court's members have both observed, would we have been subject to a relevancy objection at that point? And then would we have noticed? It's not complicated, really. And you can simply advise, we're going for an offense now that we didn't charge, and it involves something in addition that we got to prove here in addition to, that is, depraved mind murder. and you decide what you're going to do about it, defense counsel. That is not complicated. And I want to go back to Wallachy, the language specifically that was talked about from Judge Tucker's opinion. Judge Tucker opined that, quote, the elements test is difficult to use under South Dakota's current homicide statutory scheme, but it is workable if different intent or state of mind elements are accepted as lesser elements. So for the purpose of it, we accept them as lesser. And that's okay, but it doesn't deal with the notice issue. You may accept them as lesser, but they deal with a different state of mind or intent element, as Judge Tucker said. He said, let's just say they are lesser, even though they deal with a different state of mind or a different intent. Academically, I don't have a problem with that, but I have a right to defend against it, that's all. If you've got a different state of mind and a different intent element, let me know prior to my putting on a defense. That's notice.
Is there any additional notice required then under that analysis if it truly meets the standard elements test? If we just tacked one on, one more on for the more serious offense, is there any additional notice required, or is the statute sufficient?
I wouldn't have the same argument that I have today, which is to say I have something more to prove. The fact would be there's something less. Manslaughter wouldn't require proof of my intentions, merely that I had the general intention to fire the weapon, but not to cause the result. My position would be far more tenuous, and I'm not raising that argument today. That's, again, not the case that we have before the court. And our argument is not merely academic. And again, we're dealing with a young man, 16, in a set of circumstances where these young men were messing around and a gun went off. And I have a client who was evaluated and said he functions mentally like an 11 or 12-year-old. And he has delayed frontal development of his brain, and he's impulsive. If the jury's going to decide that his conduct rises to the level of a Benny Lively or those cases that I cited, that his depravity of mind, his conduct was so extreme and so outrageous, and the circumstances under which occurred, I want them to know then how my client functions. Because the legislature has long recognized in so many cases that minors are different than adults. We all know their brains aren't developed in the same way. We all know that we treat them different. We don't let them drink. We decide when they can drive, when they can't drive, the circumstances they drive, because their decision-making capacities are different. Now I have evidence, not argument, but evidence from two professionals that he is different, at least members of the jury, as part of my defense. And the overarching principle behind our argument is the right to defend. Truly, I mean, that is the overarching argument here, the principle behind our argument. He had a right to put on his defense. We successfully defended against the charge brought. We didn't get the chance to defend against the one they asked the jury to be told about after we rested our case. Based on that, it is our view that we should receive, or the conviction should be reversed, and if the court determines the appropriate remedy is to remand back for a trial, and we'll address the court, or address that issue at that time with the lower court. The last thing I want to address briefly in my 1 minute, 25 seconds, is again the statement that, oh yes, there was an argument. Okay, I have a transcript of trial testimony. I just want to bring this to the court's attention. When Mr. Youngbird, the star witness who was present in there, testified before this jury. And he was asked by Mr. Sergeant, did you tell the officer on the scene and Officer Martin, what was your response when he asked you, was there an argument? Tyus said, no, there wasn't. A Detective Pelley of the Pier Police Department asked, did it get like a heated argument? Tyus responded, just normal. 16-year-old boys yelling at each other, wrestling just a little bit. DCI agent D. Benedetto asked, are you guys fighting? Tyus answered, no. D. Benedetto, because you're pissed off at each other, are you guys? Tyus, no. D. Benedetto, just effing around. Tyus, we're just effing around. Okay, that's trial testimony. That came out and that was heard. So again, no matter how much the state wants to sit here and insist to the contrary, we're only asking the court to refer itself to the record. The motive they propounded simply didn't exist. This was a tragic accident. And if they're going to be convicted of first or second degree murder, excuse me, let us defend against it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Butler. The court will be in recess.